Actually, that type of communication has its asset in making them more alert. And then I put it this way.
They showed us how
to feel the connection. That's why she asks you who would be the mother, who would be the daughter. These are things that are going on in our head. Because we're in a relationship of remembering and coming back.
Well, this was her father's stepfather, but I mean, just for 7 years. It was like even after we were married. And when he first died, she picked up right away that nobody really cared about him, the grandfather, except for her grandmother and her. And without me saying anything, one night she came home and she got real, you know, upset and real hysterical. And she drew the line between her father not really caring. And I tried not to say too much because I didn't want to come on like I was, yeah, he's a son of a bitch, you know, type of thing. And from that point on also, she began to, not from that point, but a few months later, she began to call him Tony, her first name, and I knew that was coming from her father, and, you know, didn't want to talk about it, and he was just Tony, he wasn't grandfather, until this particular incident, you know, with the room, and with all of a sudden her coming out with a question, because I really haven't talked to him about those things, and, just, I mean, I was glad she was opening up, and, I told her a couple of stories too, and this really happened when she was about 3 or 4. I was reading a magazine.
We have a question.
What's on dreams? What do they mean? And are they misguided or misfiled information of the brain? Random things?
Well, they're all three. Number one, it's the brain has a tendency to file data, but when we're in a hurry because of the pressure of growing up and society demands us to adhere to certain disciplines, when you're young, the brain gets cluttered up. So it's a great deal of information can be misfiled in your early youth. And you have another problem. When you're growing up as a child, your brain has a tendency to photograph before it integrate knowledge and identify it in terms of understanding and applying it back as a functional behavior. So that portion of your memory where it photographs as a child, sometimes it stores the data and is unable to relate to it when it grows up because it doesn't have the logic to match it as yet. It doesn't have the experience or the reason. So it gets cluttered up, and at night when you're under relaxation, they start floating up as misfiled images threatening the person's consciousness as something bad or good, and always looking for some kind of solution to a problem. Now, some people interpret the dreams as meaning something detrimental to them, and others try to interpret it as something beneficial to them. When in actuality, sometimes it's misfiled data, and also it's certain traumatic conditions that keep popping up that aren't resolved, and they are played back as a memory bank. For instance, if a mother had anguish when she was pregnant, that when the child is born, it can have these kind of dreams that play back certain instances in their mind of anguish. Or when you're growing up as a child, you're told to do certain things and the shock came too fast and it stores in there and it's not properly filed away, it'll start popping up. So the majority of the dreams can fall under the misfile classification. There's just a few that don't fit the misfile classification. And those are the prophetic dreams, where you're actually seeing sceneries ahead in time. They haven't occurred as yet, but you're seeing it ahead. Those have a way to guide or indicate to the individual how to cope. Also, those are called visions. Then there's the threatening situation of certain dreams where you feel your whole body is drowning inside by the anguish and nobody to explain it to you. And certain things that you may feel that you couldn't cope with, they all start popping up in a dream state. For example, if the parent wants you to measure up to do certain things and you aren't ready for it, you aren't trained for it, but the time gap doesn't allow you to stay stagnant and you're forced to make every effort to keep up, the pressure of the inability to cope can lock in and make images. And the images can be so misfiled and distorted that they tend to aggravate you or even make you feel sick from the distortion. Then they call that bad dreams. Because the pressure of having to cope with the situation and you're not capable of coping, and the dream comes up as some grotesque shape. For instance, you're going to school and you have to learn new ideas every day in school. Your brain hasn't really absorbed the new ideas properly. It doesn't fit it in properly as to what it actually means for it logically for you to act back. That geometry of that information may be so partially filed that the pressure of being exposed to cope can concoct a crazy geometry in your head and end up threatening you in your sleep. All right, let's say you're a child and you've never seen, for the first time you've been exposed to a horse. But then the horse just ran through the yard and you were outside, you're looking through the window, you can't go because you're too young. And then you point and then somebody said, that's a horse. Partial images in the brain. And then along comes you having to study or be told other information within that same period that could be a screwdriver and a hammer. They're there and you reach for it. You don't know the full use of it, yet in your mind it leaves an impression. And then at night you wake up crying and your parents are wondering what's happening with you. You say you're getting a bad dream. You might be seeing a screwdriver, but the handle of the screwdriver is shaped like the horse's head. And from your exposure to the screwdriver, something you can pick up a screw, but you can't pick up a horse's head because of the teeth. Mm-hmm. You understand? And then when you try to hit it with a hammer, the hammer isn't where you doing the job, because while the handle is the horse's tail. So you have a concoction of a lot of distortions in the geometry of the photography in your brain, and you wake up crying, trying to explain them. And so these distorted geometry do set up, it begins with children in the period when they are learning to adjust, and then it's misfiled and stays in there. Now when you get to be an adult, they will play back, taking different distortions. But 9 times out of 10 is the misapplied or misfiled data that is in the dream state. They are the few that are prophetic. Yeah.
I can remember as a child, and I must have been over the age of 5, because I can remember it seemed like for years, I would have this dream of a whale, I would be swimming and a whale was about to get me. Is this the kind of thing you're talking about? Mm-hmm. I misfiled something?
Yeah.
But it seemed to happen for years. It wasn't just once or twice. Mm-hmm. It was real scary. I mean, I would wake up just...
Yeah. But you see, the thing is this, where are most dreams come from, though? It's in the subconscious memory of the sperm going to the ovum. 9 times out of 10, you can track back to many of the distortions and the images in the pregnancy level of the person. Because I know somebody who had a dream, and it was just about the time they were conceived, and by the mother, and the dream was occurring at their 38th year, at the time of the mother's conception. So they told me the dream, they were in a huge big well, and all their friends were there. They thought it was a big swimming pool, but it turned out to be a well. When they heard that the water was going to be drawn out of the well, they had to rush to get out. And then it became a mad scramble, hitting each other to get out. And then it ended up that they got out, but they were all battered up. And that was the end of the dream. But then the anguish of having their friends all bruised up in the bottom of the well. So they couldn't understand what the dream meant. And they went round and round for a long while. And then I explained it to them. Then they realized that it was exactly what they were reliving. They were reliving the time of conception. But then they saw it as in the adult geometry of their own body level.
Being underwater and swimming and being under too far to come up, and so I just start breathing and I could breathe underwater. Mm-hmm. That's really interesting.
Well, that's back to the sperm again, right? You're reliving. You see, but the thing is this, as the sperm, identity and individuality is inherent in the geometry, the survival nature is all there. These laws are working. It's the fact that you sensed it within you, because that part of you is the sperm moving to the ovum. Now think of the ovum. If the ovum was a huge target and everything was busy hitting it, here you are, all of a sudden you saw yourself standing up at the carnival on the shelf, like a target, and people are throwing darts at you. You understand? So some people had dreams like that. They saw themselves like a huge target. They didn't know why, and everybody's throwing darts at them. They were reliving the effect of the ovum being bombarded by the sperm.
And now, what's that? For example, in Persia, if somebody dreams a snake, they say you will be wealthy. Or if you dream a wedding, they say you will not be expected bad news or something like that. We have many of them. That
yeah, I understand. They do that. They identify a certain geometry or a certain images to have certain meanings, and that is what they have sorted out over the years, because it seems to repeat itself. But then when you take it back into its true context, it's also an indication of a form of diagnosis of the person's problems, because the whatever the person might want to experience and was setting up in their own mind to experience, that particular image or geometry may come up and begin to manifest. Now, let's say the father and the mother want to get married, but then before they got married, they didn't know how the financial situation would work out. But then, to their amazement, as soon as they got married, they got more financial surprise given to them at the wedding, and they went ahead and they were happy. The child sometimes is born now with this particular anguish or this particular compensation, so that they start to dream the object that represents prosperity. And therefore, the person who's diagnosing them said this is what it would be triggered back where the parent themselves might be in a position and didn't know if it would work out. And yet when it did go ahead, it all sort of turned out fine. Then also you have the reverse. Some people go into it and then it didn't work out the way they expect. The child may have a dream where the thing is doing the opposite. So they do have a basis for their origin. But the people who diagnose it or analyze it are using it from the many repetitions, and if it's consistent, then they will use that as a means of interpreting it.
So cultural symbols may not be the same symbol in a different culture then.
That's right.
And if it's also spermal or ovum memory, they're going to be changed culture. Yeah, like to say they come now from Iran to this country, and they dream something in this culture that might mean something different than that culture.
Right.
So it's hard to interpret.
That's why, you see, the thing is this. The person should try to have a universal mind or attitude to life, more so than a fixated central type of life or ethnic life. We are born in an ethnic level with our own blood relatives, yet life doesn't allow us all to remain in the same location. Even if you were living in the country you're born in, somehow you're going to leave your own family and travel away in that same country and meet other people that you're going to be totally more warm, intimate than the ones that you've born and grew up with. And this is the reason why even Yogananda was saying in his that though he was born in India and had brothers and sisters, yet his true brothers and sisters were the ones that he met years after. And the love that was exchanged and the understanding was exchanged. So we find that there are two type of families. The family that you're born in as a blood, having certain symbols to relate to, and the family of life itself, that we relate at the inward consciousness, at the creative level of our nature. And that puts us in a universal state. So here you are, my brothers and sisters. And this is in the interaction that's going on. And so for that reason, you have two type of family consciousness. The blood family consciousness and the spiritual family consciousness. Yet essentially, we are brothers and sisters in this spiritual consciousness, because atomically, we're only changing bodies to match the movie. So that's why the poet wrote, life is a stage, and we are merely actors, and we have our entrances and our exits. So one moment I come in Oriental, next moment I come in Iranian, or French, or Spanish, or German. But the inward aspect of the actor, that's the consciousness, the suit, is the costume, that's the human body. But we are playing one big movie. It's called Kriyat Ayan. And God is the producer and his own director, his own devil.
So there is a validation to the fact that people can interpret them, and it's not a random thing. That
right.
Well, traumas then are registered in the consciousness from the moment of conception. Exactly.
Yeah.
How do you, as an aware adult who wants to start cleaning up this stuff, how do you go about it?
Yeah. You can't go right away to the prenatal level. You're not gonna. You have to work your way back in the process as an adult. When the first painful sensation in your body came in the present body, when did you, could you remember what was your first illness or injury to the body? Because it's dealing from that level, it in the present body. So if you remember that, then that would be your first step in the direction to go back prior to that. So you're always working your way back. So if you had an injury 4 years ago, then you have to go to what led up to the injury prior to the 4 years. And how was the lifestyle at the time? And that's how we were able to track back. We had to go back to the injury and what preceded it. It's like a form of detective process. And it's a diagnostic process of sorting out the facts that preceded it. So many of us have different problems that come up through our lives in different years. And if you only go back prior to it, you'll always see there is something that caused the anguish. For instance, you're happy going along, having no aches or pains. Your body feels good. But then somebody makes a comment and you don't take it as serious, yet later on down the road, in that same, something happens to your body. You bump into something. You never realize that the comment could be traumatic enough to trigger a malfunction, and then they'll synchronize. And yet if you go to a horoscope and look it up, you see at that particular instant you have certain configurations that would line up to create the incident to follow. Then you go back to your biorhythms and check it. At that particular moment, the biorhythm will indicate if it's an emotional, intellectual, or a physical breakdown due to occur. So there are many other ways. If you went back with tail and camera, it would show up that this particular object was building up its magnetic field just as much as this particular person making a statement, and their bodies were synchronizing, you know, magnetic, attracted to. We are living in a gravity and magnetic field. We are composed of 144 elements. We have different unresolved decisions, which are magnetic reactions. The timing of when these things have to be resolved may seem very bizarre, very random, very strange, but they do occur to make us reevaluate ourselves. They're not bad. They're simply the necessary hurdles or challenges in order to improve the immunity of the organism.
Yes, every equinox, so many things get flared up with different people, and we just went through it yesterday. It was a fall equinox, and I've been noting people's circumstances, and what goes on there? What are those?
The temperature change of the 90-degree angle of the planet to the sun is going to set up different reactions to different bird types and different chemical patterns on their blood types.
Mm-hmm.
So when you came in, you might have come into a certain momentum of the Earth to the sun, certain configuration of the magnetic field of the mass in your own atomic structure.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a certain temperature at that point in time. Also, what was the matrix own configurations? You see, there's no helter-skelter universe. Everything is mathematically working, but in two ranges, the visible range and the invisible range. Today we call that the subatomic particle range for the invisible. We don't have any existence, an interaction as an existence by accident. Everything is working by laws of nature, but they are not obvious at the time of the encounter, because we're dealing with two speeds, a visible speed and an invisible speed. It's the invisible speed that is totally ignored, and every conclusion is built about our behavior from the visible speed. And then when we end up not matching or interacting properly, we try to find some other thing to label or place the blame on, when in actuality the invisible laws or the invisible part of your nature is interacting for you to go face the situation. So that's how come the three wise men that went to Jesus, they weren't people who had went crazy and had psychic abilities. They were kings, number one. They ruled their country, number two. And therefore, they were wealthy enough to be able to go on a vacation to go look for another king. But they were called wise men, so it means that they had certain trained abilities already. They had developed certain qualities in themselves to able to leave their country and pursue some fixed stellar movement as a guideline. They were following natural laws already. Observe it. And so we see those who are busy studying the laws of nature, they aren't always heard or recognized, yet they are the ones who we have to turn to validate many of the things we see and label and don't know why. And then there are people who are studying these same laws in their natural context, matching it and validating it. And they do show up, and then they come from two different areas. One comes in a methodical, slow, analytical way, and one comes from the imaginary quantum leap way. So both eventually end up looking at each other. Nature gives you a right brain and a left brain. We don't seem to have any one thing as an answer for the problems we live in or the situations we accomplish. We always seem to be operating on three levels, not two, three. The plus, the minus, and the neutral. Our whole universe is a trilogy or a polarity or a trinity. We can't find a single thing that doesn't conform to it. Even when you split the atom and you look at it inside, there, it's right there, a three-in-one action. So if the core of our existence and the environment is set up by the same phenomenal law, then when it comes to living our emotions day to day, we're going to be in the same polarity. We have a physical condition, we have an intellectual, and we have a emotional. These three forces are going to act on us. Now, put it another way. There are only three words in the English language, or in any language for that matter, that all life is centered about. The first word is be. B-E, be. Now that has no geometry, but it's totally self-inclusive and contains everything in it. You couldn't leave a single thing out from B. And yet B doesn't have any geometry. And it's one part of your identity that you can't seem to get rid of. Even when you're sound asleep, B still buzzes inside of you. And always promises you more honey. Yet, when you wake up, you live with I. And I is individuality. Very, very specific. And make sure that no other form or geometry will step in front of it or take its place. I is first, and I is integrity and all there is that would allow for total freedom to the excess of hurting itself. I would claim all those rights. I, you know. B will not condemn I, but will present me as a means of monitoring I. Now, me is that funny fella in every one of us, because me never seems to run out. More of me. And that's called memory. And the more I tries to show off to be, me keeps reminding him of how it mucks up. It may be the mirror of you, but that's exactly what me does. And so between pure individuality as I and pure existence as be, the joy is in the me. So, even when we hear wise men realize themselves between their I and their be, the thing they give the greatest contribution is to the me. You see me, you see the Father. thou shalt have no other gods before the me. See? So me is that reminder, that monitor that holds all things in focus. And since there are no sins, only misapplied decisions, which of the three is to blame for the misapplication of the decision?
I.
Then the question comes up, I does not know how to make decision, it should get itself a coin and flip it. Two heads it act, one tail it know. Two of other three it'll act. In that way, I never gets blamed for making wrong decisions. That's how come the oracle and wise men and all the other different ways, tarot card, all these things came up. I Ching and all these things came to guide I. So, for that reason, we live this wonderful process. Yet, I, me, be, they are all acting as one, and that one is immortal. Will always be.
With the be being neutral. No, the me being neutral. Which one is neutral?
The B is neutral. It always presents I with the Bill called me. And so me constantly reminds I to fulfill its obligation because I loves to make promises to itself but it don't fulfill it. But B can't help it. Then present it with the bill called me. And so, mirror, mirror on the wall, who is the fairest of them all? Me.
Me.
No, me.
Me happy.
Right. Enlightenment and liberation is emerging for all of us in the language we speak. That's why in the beginning was the Word. And the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And the Word was made flesh and dwells in men. It is when you go through the process and identify what the three words are that constitute existence, this is the three words, be, me, I. And it's funny how these three words trigger the whole existence into all levels of behavior. It has every possible means of creativity working for it. There is no end to the potential that is locked up in those three words. It's constantly flowing.
Are those representative of the ego, or are any of them representative like of the ego or the superconscious or God within?
God.
I mean, it's like God, the me.
Is the combination of the three words in a unified flow. Those same three words, the moment they begin to have motion, that unification
those three words, the moment they become united and have a unification, they only have one end product, and that is harmony or goodness. And to personalize goodness, godness. You see what I mean? So God, as a principle, and as a personality process, and as an identity, all these three are locked up in it as one. B makes it impersonal. I makes it very personal. And me takes everything into account. That there is no wastage or abuse imposed upon it, that it corrects and maintains itself in perfect balance and perfect unity. So God or goodness or godliness is the context of it in motion. Now Jesus, he referred to it as Father. Many other religions refer to it as Father. Some refer to it as Mother. In this society among American Indians, they call it Great Spirit or Great Principle. But however we look at it, in terms of personalness, there is nothing more personal than T-O-U-C-H. 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 That ties it all up for you. Because B cannot exist without touch. And I cannot exist without touch. And me cannot exist without touch. And if you look at the structure in which these three conditions operate, it operates in a cellular substance that can only relate to touch. The eye sees, the ear hears, the nose smells, the mouth tastes, but the skin, the whole container is touch. Now the eyes are made of tissue. Still can touch it. The ears are made of tissue. Still can touch it. The nose are made of tissue. Still can touch it. The lips are made of tissue. Still can touch it. But what is touch made up of? No answer. But ouch. Ouch! Ouch! Every time you squeeze any part, it ouches for you. But you gotta touch it to make it ouch. So you see, that's the comedy of the existence. Yet it's permanent and it's immortal, meaning it never goes out of existence. So the yogis, those are the unified conscious people or realized people, at the time they were using the terminology, or finally ended up by taking three words to represent the Godhead: Sat, Chit, Anandam. Sat is the actual existence of whatever is here. It's existing. And therefore they call that be. Be is existence for them. Be here, be, that's to be and not to be is the what? Good. Crest of the ion. You'll start looking for the ions again. And chit is consciousness, and that's I. The moment you take your first breath, I am alive. I can breathe, I can think, I can know, I can do, I can do, and I can do, and I can do, and I can do. And so that's the I in you. Anandam is the experience. Now, the experience is either painful or joyful. That's why they call it bliss. And that's the me. You don't have any way to relate to your experiences other than your memory. You can't keep track of your experience unless you have a memory. You don't know if it's joyful or painful unless there's a memory. So the anandam is the me in you, the memory bank. We live reminding ourselves from the memory bank. And so they themselves try to put the whole context of creative consciousness into three ideas. Existence, it can't go away. Consciousness, you can't function if you're not conscious. And what is the purpose of functioning is to experience. So, bliss. And I just put it in today's language and say, be is existence, and be is non-geometrical, and existence is non-geometrical. And I is consciousness, because everything wants to say, I am this, I am that. There's no other way for it to function or talk. So you're conscious the moment you breathe and you say, I. But then it's the experience that follows from the breathing. What do you do? How do you relate? How do you recall your experiences? How do you compare your experiences in terms of pain or joy? And so that's the me in you. The memory, the part that is always reminding you or monitoring or reinforcing yourself. So a therapist now tries to organize a balance of the flow. And that's what the purpose of the wise man or the realized person is trying to do. How to keep the balance and the flow with the be, the I, and the me. And over the many, many centuries and the many, many mistakes and the accomplishments, they've only found one approach that always works. Thy will be done. Let go, let God. Flip the coin, act. They haven't found a functional, practical solution other than that to ensure pain-free experiences. No one loves to be in a state of pain. Even the typewriter or the tape recorder. it's that why we try constantly to reach out. And what are we trying to overcome? We have the pain to live through. We have the pain to rectify. But the method is never told what to do to overcome the pain, other than thy will be done, let go, let God, or consult the oracle as a means to act. And the pain is essential as a means to develop strength or immunity. If you never had any kind of confrontation, there's no way for the immunity to develop. That's why your wise men that come back, and after they realize, they only offer us one process, one technique, and that is to go through it. They don't know of any way that you can get around it, and they don't know that you can postpone it or eradicate it. They only know that the highest process is to go through. That's why they say, in all confidence, pick up your cross and follow me, but don't pick up mine. And for that reason, each one is born to experience his or her horoscope, the scope of the horror of the process of going through it, and not to be afraid of it. And for any consolation in it is overcoming the unconsciousness of it. To him that overcometh, I will not send forth a second time. What is it you have to overcome?
Me.
Me, right. And being unconscious of it. See, you can't become unconscious of the me in you. The I is constantly reminded by the me, because B will always be there presenting the bill. To I, and me is the bill. So for that reason, we gain this by the process of going through. To him that overcome the me, you won't have to go forth again to do it all over. There is no more me to clean up. But look at it another way. When there is no more me to clean up, would be satisfied?
Bills paid. The bills paid.
B will not be satisfied. You know why?
Yeah, I won't let it.
No, no. B itself would be bored. And will start again creating an I to give it freedom to generate a use for me. You see? But me would emerge again from the bee. That's how come let us make man in our own image and likeness, male and female created them, and breathed bread of life into man, and man became living soul. B cannot stay stagnant or non-active. It must create. So even it creates I as a form of expression for itself, and give I total freedom of individuality to squander away its
existence and to confront it with the bill of squandering. Yet if me was to phase out and no more me exists, and only I and B, B will be forced to generate a me. It would not able to function because I and B alone would not operate properly. The me will have to come back as a third function. So you see, there is no way for you to be unconscious, and there is no way for you to be non-existing, non-immortal. You are already immortal. And when you lock in to the immortalness of yourself in the I state, me state, and be state, you are unified. Free men all, Lord of yourself. You have full control of B, me, I.
That is such an interesting concept. That's such an interesting concept. Such a psychologically simple.
So you light up.
So, if you get you dream, then what's talking in your sleep?
That's your misfiled data and the reruns of me. And so I and me are busy talking to each other in the sleep. But who is sleeping? The I, the me, or the B? That would
me.
The me.
The me.
Mm-hmm. The me is sleeping.
Yeah. And
it's
so
the action.
That's
the
memory.
Memory.
Why does it respond?
Why
does it respond?
Why is it what?
Respond.
Why doesn't it respond?
Why does it?
Why does it respond?
If it doesn't have any contact with me, how does it respond?
Me responds because B uses it to confront I. B stores me and stores I. And I has no place to operate in without B. I could not come out into existence before B. And so for that reason, me is already existing with I, and both are stored in B. Then B is greater than I and greater than me. But B is totally helpless without I and the me operating in it. Even though it stores it, B would be useless and serve no purpose. Therefore, it craves exchange and interaction between I and me. So, who needs your love? B, I, or me? Which of the three needs the love?
B.
Good.
Well, wouldn't B be the love? Wouldn't that be, if B is neutral, wouldn't that be the heart space? You said the heart chakra was neutral?
Yes, but it needs love more.
That's your seat of love, though.
Yes. And I can ignore it. And I can only be reminded by be through the me. But be is in the anguish always to assure I that it will always be there.
Oh, this way then, be is almost like the soul that is not touched, but it's touched.
Now you sing the song, what we sang today.
Right.
Yeah.
Listen, listen to my heart song. I will not forget you and I will not forsake you.
Right.
It's B that sings the song and guarantees the assurance to I that the me principle is there to back it up.
Right.
But never I going to sing to B and tell it, because I doesn't have anywhere to fall back on, and I would be lying to itself that it could tell B it'll never forsake it or forget it. I will go off and squander off. But B is the principle that cannot let down I, but it'll always remind I of what it's doing by presenting it with me. I say, look at me and see, this is your behavior. But it can't withdraw. So for that reason, they say God needs your love more than you realize. But in order to keep you fooling yourself, they tell you, you need God more. Well, does this glass need me more than I need the glass? Right? The water would be on the floor. So who made the glass? No, the glass is fragile if I let go of my hands from it, right? Who's going to complain now? The glass going to complain, you smashed me up? No, I complain to myself how clumsy I am for dropping the glass. No, I made a fragile object. Mm-hmm. Do you see why we say we could never see you? How can you literally say with the ego or the fishes, you're not going to forsake or forget God? Not possible. It's automatically you're going to... But the creative intelligence that put the whole thing together is the one that is assuring the object that it's not letting it down. I'm not going to drop you on the floor. And I keep it clean and also.
Misapplied decisions are made by I, but me has to face the suffering through.
Exactly. That's why there really aren't any scars permanent in B. Mm-hmm.
Right.
There are no permanent scars in B.
Scars are memory.
Right.
Me.
Yeah.
So if the heart is neutral, mm-hmm. which way does the I and me go as far as top or bottom?
The me, the heart is neutral. Mm-hmm. And the I is the upper part from your cervical pituitary in the top of the head.
Mm-hmm.
And the me goes from the lumbar sacral to the coccyx. And B is heart, right central. So the pure in heart.
Okay.
You get it?
So I puts the stuff in,
mm-hmm.
me has to face the consequences.
That's right.
Okay.
And the anguish is in the B.
The B.
If you're going to pass it out or not pass it out. After you put it in.
Oh, that's good.
So this is the realization we live with. Then we are functional, and healthy, our health, is all there is. Now the real love of God is the healthiness of your beingness. Because I, me, and B are all flowing together as one synchronized unit.
The divinity.
The divinity, right, mm-hmm. exactly. So you're not no longer torn up with possessions. You're no longer torn up with a self-image that I'm brown, black, yellow, male or female. Or no. I breed, therefore I am.
I relate, therefore I retain. And I share, therefore I'm everything. And for that process now, your creativity starts to flow, because B is creativity. Mm-hmm. And B is self-sustaining. And here's the interesting phenomenon. God isn't punching no clock. He's punching customers. And he's resting one day a week. So for that reason, when you look at yourself in that aspect of service, your creativity opens up for you. But if you don't, and you're only looking at the clock to punch, then creativity in you starts to phase down. And you get locked in only to the eye. And then the anguish builds up in the eye. Because there's nowhere for you to satisfy eye under those circumstances. But if you phase out that particular attitude and get back to the creative consciousness as a media that allows you to express your creativity, then you're working for yourself.
Deeper than you thought.
Yes.
Since Eliot bought us that book, The Incorruptibles, I've become fascinated with some of the saints that stop eating. What is what happened when you were talking earlier about the blood types and the need for the fiber and the tissue? What happens when that type of consciousness, you know, is developed to where, you know, the need for the food that we eat, not of the ether or the air? What happens? How does that transformation take?
The transformation is in three ways. Soul and nutrition, the fifth rule is live to eat in order to live not to eat. This is a rational evolution which is observed by the way the structure of society is moving from the child to the adult. When the adult doesn't want to eat anymore, they just fade down lesser and lesser. But that's a progressional phase out based on illness. It's not a phase out by the body's ability to build up its own allergens and phase off the need of eating. You see, what you're doing, the non-eating state due to illness, that's one of the handicaps of it. When it goes through its normal process of phasing down on its own, then it switches over at 70 into a natural Bratterian function. It's already built into the DNAs and RNAs to do that. Well, we don't know that till we go through it, and a lot of people had to sick and die over the centuries to find this particular phenomenon. That's the rational progression, but God doesn't have no overnight or emancipation of society. God has what is called an individualistic process of emancipation for society. So each person has his own time to his own horoscope, that is, to make the breakthrough. And in one lifespan, you have three periods, 30 to 35, 45 to 65, and 85 to 95. In one lifespan, you will make this transition if you work through it.
the purpose behind is to let the human being realize that if he abstain by an injury, or if he abstain by some kind of an illness, this is an imposition of his own willpower. If he decides that the lifestyle is not possible and certain conditions came to impose it upon him, that forces him to have to give up eating in a calamity or otherwise, then he finds himself adhering to an abstinence process. Now, these are valid self-imposed abstinence or injuries. But the third process is the progressional natural law of phasing out of it and experiencing it. The abstinence and the pain-induced conditions, they will always be popping up as means to put us into that level. But then when we deviate, we have the consequences again. A person can abstain and then go off. A person can hurt himself and then go off, but then he may come back. See? But when you're progressively phasing out, this is naturally occurring within you, so then the body is accepting this process of phasing out. So the breatharian process is your actual destination. But some people come into it through dedication and working with a lot of ill people. They make the sacrifice that the ill person needs the food more than them, or they make a sacrifice in that particular condition. You had a question to ask?
No.
But that would be the situation. You can abstain, or you can be in an injury situation, or the natural progression. Now, not many people can abstain. Not too many people can get the injury. But the natural progression is for everybody. But the first two, everybody will pass through. Pain and the desire to abstain because you're sick. As I say, if you eat food and you get sick, and I offer it to you again, you don't want it, then you can carry on for 3-4 days, you're going to abstain. So that's the rational way. Nature will provide those opportunities for you to make decisions along that way. But then if you understand how it's working already, then it comes on natural.
It seems like there's a common theme with many of the saints that experienced that. The common theme is that they suffered some kind of really tremendous illness.
Yes.
There's a commonality.
That's what you're observing. You see, the holistic life or the sane life is what they call saint or sante health. We haven't come any further than words we're saying to ourselves, that man has and continues to look for the holistic way of living. And he has to come through the avenues of pain in many different ways. And non-eating state is obvious to pain. That's one of the most obvious therapy there is. And I was sick, even when I was groaning with pain, broken bone, I didn't want to touch food. Even if I didn't eat the bad food to make me sick. It's a funny phenomenon. You just don't have a craving for food when the body's in aches and pains. So this is you'll see as the case histories are gathered up, many of them made the transition to the non-eating state and the non-breakdown state by the intense pain or the intense illness. Well, put it this way. If the bacteria in you wants to eat you, and you don't give him nothing to eat through your mouth, will he get anything to eat? The rest of the fellas inside, they can do what?
Starve.
Well, if they're starving because you don't put in anything, what are they going to turn around and do to this fellow who's eating them?
Eat him.
Yeah, right. That's exactly nature's law of allopathic medicine and homeopathic medicine. You see? She has to have both laws to work inside. The very same force field eliminates the intruder or the disrupting force. So these are great ones who became sane realize that if they didn't put in anything and lie down there and or kneel down there and pray and pray and pray for the release, but the endorphins will go to work. They got to. Even at that time they didn't know about endorphins. Today we know that our body's own immune level exists. Well, what is comical about it, even though it exists and they're placed there for our well-being, they got to be tricked to work for us. That's how come there's a research going on right now. Man essentially is a liar to himself 99% of the time. And it is, that's why they're studying this particular phenomena in the bloodstream. That he needs some kind of a illusion to trigger him.
That's your mantra then.
Yeah, right. Yeah. He needs something like that to trigger him into the action. That's why there's no commandment, thou shalt not lie. It makes more sense as a valid statement than a valid... You can't really trigger your brain from the time you cut the cord to breathe unless you put some kind of a stimulus to trigger it. So it would be highly impractical to ask God to tell the first pair, go ahead, enjoy yourself, multiply. What they're going to do? They don't have any way to, they don't have an experience to refer to or to relate to before as a memory bank, how to multiply. They couldn't trigger multiplication from themselves. They couldn't trigger enjoy, because if you never had anything put in the computer, how it's going to play it back? So for that reason, you begin to see how unique a process this creative intelligence set the thing in motion for the drama to go on. And if the creative intelligence as B is not present in his own creation, taking on a form, the form representing I and me would not operate or couldn't operate. Just I, me would be impossible to operate without B sustaining it. You have to have B totally neutral, containing I and me to make it function. And the game is between the I and the me, not with the B. The B is sitting back and allowing I and me to play this crazy game of do and don't do and correct. And that's how we begin to realize how well it was organized. And when you realize it, then you begin to appreciate the creative self, because there is no other great or glorious contribution to the creative self than to live in synchronous harmony with it. You see it right away that I, me, be makes more sense in living in the now. And the tomorrows and the yesterdays are no real threats, or they're not necessary to aggravate the brain anymore. Living in the now, acting in the now, serving in the now, is sustaining itself. But we have to come to it. we have to make the mistakes to build up the immunity, build up the strength to want to relate to it in the present. If we don't have it, we can't. There's no way. You couldn't ask a child to do something he never learned. And even when they say, you know, I like that statement, when everything else fails, follow the instructions. How are you going to follow instructions? Where you get it right? You see what I mean? Where will you get instructions? So it has to be there before, waiting for you to do it.
Going back to what you said about male and female, we created he. Male and female then were created before Adam and Eve.
Yes. See, if you go back to the Bible writing, you see there are two creations. That's what Edward Casey made the reference to. Most of us do not understand it. Why he came back as Edward Casey, he was actually Amun Ra, the great high priest. He came back to teach men and remind men of the principles of creation. But he himself pointed out that there were two creations, the actual creation of the universe with the Big Bang and the man emerging out and going out to function. And then the Garden of Eden is more of a focal point of behavior for men. And that's how Yukteswar also came along and told Yogananda. And Yogananda couldn't see why would God punish the first two pair of people for having done something which they couldn't help do but had to do. So what are you going to punish them for? You see? They had to do it even if they didn't want to do it. So he couldn't see they being punished. And he asked Yukteswar. And Yukteswar told him the thing is allegorical. Had nothing to do with what he tells. But then when you bring it into a functional health process, we can narrow it down now that all life forms operate with certain blood types as a measuring process to give them individuality and lifestyle so they can have something to interact. So a creative bee giving individuality to its creation set up the four types as a reminder process to interact. So it had to build a body that would interact 90% of the time with fiber and just 10% or 1% of the time on a tissue. If it made it totally tissue, to rely on tissue all the time, wouldn't be practical. And that's why Miyakushi, when he came along with macrobiotic, he didn't find 100% tissue eater, and he didn't find 100% fiber eater. But he sure found that the chemistry was 80-20 to be normal. And that's what's so unique about it, that if you stay within the chemical normalcy of the body, everything is flowing on time. So we have ways to validate it or measure it by litmus test, but that is an indicator that the organism is working for its best good to stay at that level. And the extremes are not. Well, we wouldn't know it if we never went through it by making mistakes. So here we come back to the beautifulness of it. We don't have years to our life. We have revolutions around the sun. So you're endless and you're youthful all the time. And that's like the picture cocoon was such a bit. The cocoon showed you that intrinsically your atomic mass utilizing a tissue fold to interact. But the tissue fold is synchronous to the motion of the planetary systems. So when they asked the people from the other planetary systems, if they'll take them, and if there was anything as immortality. And the answer is very beautiful. It says, we will explore new dimensions of life, but as far as saying eternal, he didn't say immortal. He said, that's unexpected. I like the way he put it, unexpected. If you expect eternalness, you're going to get disappointed. If you expect immortality, you're going to get that disappointment. As long as unexpected, you're always living in the now. With newer and better opportunities of exploring. See? So they're taking them to other dimensions of life. Explore.
Thank you. Beautiful. See, it's so simple.
Well, you know, I met one friend here in Arizona, and he always makes the remark, he says, life is simple, but difficult to apply.
Life is simple.
His name is Andy, yeah. The chief war eagle. That's his comment. He said, life is simple but difficult to apply. And it's true when you realize the convex vision of seeing through mass. Anytime you have the ability to bridge that time-space condition, you see the simplicity, yet you can't apply it. It's funny. Though you can see through time, yet the clumsiness of applying yourself to it has to be there too. No one can see through your clumsiness, but they can sure see through that you got to face the situation, and they can tell you the actual day you're going to face it. But to help you overcome your clumsiness to go through it, no. You have to work out your own clumsiness.
The ones who get to the level like Jesus and Babaji and those guys, what allows them to sustain that state?